is nothing constant? Like the speed of light. Nothing travels faster, okay? Well, no. Forget that one too. Meet Professor Marcelo Gleiser, the handsome, charismatic Brazilian professor of physics at Dartmouth College. His book, Imperfect Creation, is a delight. But it also says space ain't space, that it travels at fantastic speeds, and that the universe could come from nothing.
Well, if you think of general theory of relativity, which is the theory that Einstein came up with to explain gravity, that says that matter affects the geometry of space, then what you realize is that if space is expanding, right, if the universe is growing in time, the galaxies are moving apart from each other, then if you play this movie backwards, clearly at some point in the past, you're going to come to a moment where everything is stuck in, on top of each other, sort of a big blob. And of course, when you squeeze matter like that, you know, temperatures soar, pressures soar, and then you are very hard pressed to apply laws of nature, the laws of physics that you know, to situations where they basically break down. So what happens is that if we use the normal laws that we have to describe the universe very close to the beginning, they break down, okay? So we come to a point which is called the singularity. So classically, and this is something that Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose showed in the 60s and 70s, classically you are led to conclude that at the beginning there was a point, a singularity point, where general relativity breaks down. Now, of course, that's because the theory, as every other theory in physics, has limitations, right? You have to apply it within its validity. And when you get close to the beginning, you just can't. You have to use another theory, right? And this other theory is quantum mechanics, which is basically the physics that describes how atoms and molecules operate. Why is that? Well, because the universe is so tiny at that point that it sort of starts to behave like an atom does. So you have to create a marriage between quantum mechanics and general relativity, you know, the physics of the very small and the very large. And unfortunately, this is a real tough one, right? I mean, you can get the best justice of the peace out there, and it's not going to happen. It has not happened for the last 40 years. People have been trying to do this, actually 50 years. You know, superstring theories, quantum cosmology. What can you say? Well, one thing that you can say is that since in quantum mechanics, everything fluctuates. For example, an electron doesn't sit still like you and I do. It's always sort of jittery. I call it the jitterbug cosmos because there's always this vibration everywhere. So if you go back to the beginning and you think of general relativity, and that is the theory of space, you say, well, quantum mechanically, space also vibrates. Space is also fluctuating, and you cannot really say that there is such a thing as a zero-point energy. Just like if you're, you know, sitting still, there is no energy there, but if you vibrate, there is some energy of motion there. So the universe, even though it's in a zero-energy state, has fluctuations about that zero-energy state. And from these fluctuations, you can actually create little bubbles of space that can possibly grow and become our universe. So the solution that we have now for the question of creation is that the universe in the beginning was this sort of quantum mechanical soup of space. Space is bubbling around, and eventually one of these bubbles had the right properties to keep growing and to become the universe we live in. So the universe, in essence, is the result of a quantum fluctuation of space. Now, does this solve the first cause problem? Well, if you think like Stephen Hawking does, for example, he'd say, sure, this is it. You know, we apply the laws of physics and we have a universe coming out of nothing. But if you're a little more keen on thinking philosophically, you realize that you do not, that you're really stuck with a problem here, because in order to create this theory of quantum cosmology, you had to use the laws of quantum mechanics, you had to use general relativity. And so the question then becomes, okay, you have a nice little model here that describes how something can come out of nothing. Where do these laws that you use to build your model come from? Why does this operate this way? And to that kind of question, science really cannot say anything.
Now, the other problem I have, the second one, which you describe in the book, which I find rather delicious, incomprehensible but delicious, that in the beginning there was a very, 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 very fast expansion of the universe, faster than the speed of light, And of course, the problem, as you put it, is that people say, hey, you can't have anything going faster than this. Well, you can't have matter going faster than this bit. But this is space. Space can travel faster than the speed of light. But what is this space that is traveling so fast?
Well, that's a good question. You have to really think in abstract terms here. And I know that for us, space doesn't seem to have structure. It's just where we move about. It's kind of like a stage where life unfolds, if you want. Things happen and the theater remains. So the space is actually not simple like that. This is sort of what we call the Newtonian classical space. Space actually has structure. It's something that is dynamic. It's not just an inert thing out there. And so what Einstein showed with his theory of relativity, and it's been confirmed with many, many observations, is that space actually responds to the presence of matter. It bends. And so does time. Time slows down when there is a lot of matter there. So you can't really think of space and matter as separate entities anymore. They're sort of together. And in fact, you can't even think about empty space anymore, because the way we think of matter right now is through this concept of field. And a field essentially is the manifestation in space of the source of something. So for example, if you light a candle, right? If you light a candle and you're not touching the candle, but you're close to it, you're going to feel the heat from the candle. So you can say that there's a temperature field around that flame that drops with the distance. In fact, it drops with the square of the distance. And so you can say that the presence of the candle at point X affects the space around it. And you can say that is a field. Okay, well, that is true for everything that has mass, for example, because there you create a gravitational field. And it's true for everything that has electric charge, because then you have an electric field. And essentially what you find out is the whole of space is filled up with fields. So there is no such thing as an empty space anymore. You have to really think that everything is a field out there. And so you don't separate space from matter. You just think that everything is field, and space is essentially filled up with these things. And so it responds. Now, the thing about space itself, you have a distance between two points and you want to measure that distance, that's cool. And what inflation is telling is that, well, the distance between these two points can stretch like a rubber sheet. It can stretch at any speed, really. It doesn't matter. Now, if you have electrons stuck to these two little points, they are going to only move up to the speed of light or less, actually, because they have mass. But the space where they're anchored can move at any speeds. There's no law kind of limiting the speed of space.
I can see how you have fun working in your box. I can also see why you write so wonderfully in your book with personal anecdotes. So in between some of the ways you describe, as you have just now, the theory and in some of the practicality of physics, you relate it to what your daughter says and what your family says and how you grew up as a boy. This is essential to you, isn't it, as a writer?
It is. And that's now we're going from science to nonfiction writing, essentially, which is, I think that if you're going to propose to a reader to embark on a very long journey, this is a very long journey, then you have to know who your guide is and why it's worth taking the trip. And so I think it's very, very important that the reader knows that I am just another guy who has a life. And in fact, as I explain in that book, I had some very, very sad moments in my past life when I was a child. You know, my mother died when I was 6. And essentially that traumatic event pretty much shaped the person I am today. And so it's really important, I think, to put yourself into the story that you're telling, to show that your science doesn't come out of the blue, but is really part of who you are as a human being.
It really is a terrific book, Imperfect Creation, by Marcelo Gleiser, who's Professor of Physics at Dartmouth College in the States.